Hey, everybody. Welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithelday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers for ATQ, Badwater. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. It is wet in October, and it feels like Oregon again.
Well, let's talk about some indoor sports then. I understand you went to the basketball press conference yesterday. How'd that go? Anything interesting?
Yeah, the men started out with open practice, and it was just kind of a brief thing. The intention was that they had closed exhibition games in Canada and whatnot, and really haven't had an opportunity for the public, for any of the fans to see the team in an exhibition kind of environment. So they did an abbreviated open practice, and you got a chance to see where the team is at and how they're doing. I mean, they've had a rash of preseason injuries, mm-hmm. and there are virtually no players that are entering the season without having had some sort of injury over the summer and the fall camp. So they're nursing some of that. And it was a good opportunity to see some of the veterans coming back, some of the other people coming into play, and the new bodies that they've added. I guess Will Richardson look great? I think over the course of the practice, he threw maybe 6 or 7 threes and only missed one. And Folley looks good. In fact, there was a couple of fast break deals. And I'm sure they do this kind of situation where they wouldn't be doing it normally in a game, but in an open practice kind of a thing where you're just fast breaking and that kind of stuff. He did some dribbling. He dribbled down the court to pressure and threw in a jumper. The second time he got the ball stolen, but he's not a point guard. Bill launch a nice little 15-foot jumper. So the team has some potential, but Altman will be the first to admit that they are slow to get up to speed just because of the preseason injury issues and just having enough bodies to practice with.
They
did a Q&A in between those the men's and women's basketball practices. The players did a kind of getting to know you kind of a thing, and then Altman had some remarks. And then they brought the women's basketball team out, and the women's basketball squad did the same thing, kind of getting to know you, and Graves had some remarks. And then the women did a full practice, full 2.5-hour practice. And you got a chance to see what exactly is involved with the practices. They start out with warm-ups, and then they get into what Graves describes as the vitamins with drills, ball handling drills and that kind of stuff, with having basketball dribbling in both hands, and all the players get down to squatting level and then come back up. And then they start going through different forward ball handling dribbles, first with it's with two balls, and they'll pass the ball back and forth to another player that's backing up in front of them. And then They do approaching to the basket and shooting type drills. And I got to say, when it comes to ball handling skills, all four of the freshmen that we have look really good, but especially Chance Gray and Grace Van Sluten. And they looked outstanding when they were doing just that, the basic ball handling stuff.
Anything stand out to you in particular beyond those?
Well, like Stel, all four of the freshmen are really good. Asai has some good ball handling skills, but I don't think she was quite on the level of Gray and Van Sluten. And yeah, Grace Van Sluten, she's the real deal, and she has a huge all-encompassing package that, if you looked at the exhibition game, you saw that on full display. I mean, if she was pressed to, she could be a point guard, or, you know, she can be a forward, or she can drive the basket, or she can hit threes. She's got great ball handling skills, like I said. And I really don't think Chance Gray is that far behind. They're really neck and neck. You know, they're both five stars. And I think as the season moves on, we're going to see really good players in Asai and Gray. And the Ducks are going to need it because they're down to 10 players. I mean, in the exhibition game, Graves said, yeah, we're using them because they're all going to get time on the floor. We have to use them.
Did you get to see Tahina Pau Pau?
I did. Yeah, and she looks good. You know, I was thinking as I was watching the practice that the player that was really standing out to me, I'm going to segue into the whole point guard issue, is Taylor Hansen. Mm-hmm. During practice, she's the most vocal out on the floor. She's giving instructions, communicating to everybody. And I really think that initially we're going to see her acting in a point guard kind of a role. But I think she's going to be doing it in conjunction with Tahina Pau Pau. Because Pau Pau is also vocal and communicative, but not the same way as a fifth-year senior who knows exactly how to be a court general. And I really think that Pau Pau is going to pick up on the example. And I'm willing to wager that we see a different Pau Pau as the season rolls on from what we see at the very beginning of the season, what we saw last season.
Hansen's the transfer from Arizona State, right?
Yes.
Do you think that, you know, it'd be mighty strange for it to be an entirely new team, wouldn't it? You know, like there's, you know, Graves takes some time to build some relationships with players. Like, do you really think that Hansen has a shot of knocking Pau Pau out of her spot?
No, I don't. I think she's going to be used in conjunction. And yeah, it may be that what I'm seeing in practice is kind of a practice situation. It's a practice drill, like, you know, in Folly, taking the ball and drilling down to the basket is not something that you'll necessarily see in game, but you know, it's a learning tool for the player and for the players around them.
Did Graves had any interesting remarks?
He did. He had some, and I think I'm going to write up a transcription of what the coaches said. The whole team really is still kind of broken up over the whole Sedona Prince situation.
Yeah, I imagine.
They only found out about it. They knew that it was on the horizon, but the determination to go the route of, okay, it's going to have to be surgically repaired, it's going to end the season, and the impact on the team really only happened in the days leading up, to that first exhibition game.
Well, you know, I guess what I, you know, because there's so much turnover with Graves' team, I guess I would be worried a little bit about leadership and, you know, I'd be looking to Sedona Prince, you know, because she's so vocal on and off the court, you know, with, you know, women's issues and charitable works and other things, like, you know, now that she's decided to sit this out and prepare for her professional transition, like, you know, I imagine that's probably the thing more than anything else is sort of hanging over this team, because it's got the talent. Like, that much is obvious. Like, it's really clear, you know, all the talent that it's got. And, you know, I think the Pau Pau will be a strong leader for this team. It's nice to, you know, because Hansen, you know, is super experienced, right? Like, I think she played 4 seasons at ASU, and I don't recall her ever missing a game. You know, but beyond that, like, it's, you know, it's a real young team, and I have to think that, like, missing out on, you know, Prince's leadership, you know, is going to be something that sort of hangs over the team, at least, you know, until they really, you know, get started playing and people emerge and sort of the team sorts itself out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that'll be the case. When I was watching them practice, I saw a pretty good mesh of what was going on in, you know, in how players were interacting with each other, you know, through body language and communication and that kind of stuff. And it seemed like a team that's taking steps forward toward being a team. And when I was watching this, I was thinking, you know, I really would have liked to have been a fly on the wall on the last few practices of last season and compare what I'm seeing here to what that fly on the wall might have seen toward the end of last season that caused the exodus of all those former 5 stars.
You know, well, we'll see, know, and it's not like there's, you know, nobody from, you know, like India Rogers, you know, is with the team as well. And
she's fantastic, you know. She was the spark plug on the exhibition game that got the team going. And, you know, she and Papa have great ball handling skills in the practice situation as well. It was just that I thought there was a few of the freshmen that looked just about as good as.
I mean, it's such a freshman, you know, team, yeah. You know, Kennedy Basham, Chance Gray and Asai and Van Sluten, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, it's entirely possible that Oregon's going to have 4 freshmen on the floor, you know, for much of the year. Yep. And so it'll be interesting to watch, you know, that gel, you know, it's sort of like, it's not quite a total reset button for Graves. But like, it's close. And last year, you know, had a disappointing conclusion. Like, it felt like the team never really came together. And that was with a lot of talent, too.
Excuse me. And, I think we're seeing a reset button that is not, dissimilar to Sabrina's freshman year and all the freshmen that were there. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can necessarily expect the same results, but, you know, we saw a huge maturation in that team that year from when they started to unexpectedly advancing into the NCAA tournament the way that they did. And we've got some very talented freshman again this year.
All right. Well, we'll, as basketball starting up, you know, we're going to have, you know, some basketball coverage, you know, on the site. Adam Holland is going to be writing a profile in Nafali Dante to go up a little later this week. SB Nation is going to be releasing its top 25 list coming soon. We're going to have a contribution to that, and contributions from all the sites across the network. I'm looking forward to next week seeing the write-up of all the comments, because as far as I can tell, I think you were the only media person who was there.
I think I saw some other media people, but they were off up in the media section. I was pretty close to the bench.
Oh, good, rubbing elbows. I love it.
Yeah.
All right, so let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk some women's volleyball. So, Badwater, speaking of being the only media person on the floor, the women's volleyball team has had a bit of a mini resurgence. But, you know, some of these matches have not been televised, or at least some of the ones that are coming up. Oregon women's volleyball is back at home this weekend, right?
Yes. Yes. Against the Washington schools, Washington and Washington State. And if you'll recall, that was our first weekend up in the state of Washington where we lost Hannah Pukis to injury. Yeah. And we lost a couple of 5-set matches up there.
Yeah, that was tough. The Washington and Washington State swing without Hannah Pukis was real tough. But Oregon gets a chance for revenge here in Eugene. Looks like you can stream these games. The Friday game against Washington, the Wear Pink game, is going to be on the Oregon live stream. And then the Wazoo game on Sunday is going to be on Pac-12 Oregon. Which, you know, that if you're a streaming person, which I'm a streaming person, I like doing that while I'm working on football stuff. You know, is great, real high paced, real enjoyable stuff to watch. And you've been covering these, the ladies in person. What have you seen out of this team, especially with Pukis coming back? I know that they swept ASU last Sunday, and I think they came close to sweeping Arizona too, right?
Yes. Yes, they did. Her presence, it can be a game changer. The center is the quarterback on the court. Mm-hmm. And you can make the quarterback analogy all you like. If you lose your starter quarterback, there's very, very likely to be a drop off. So I think that's a little bit of the reason why the volleyball team struggled against the Washington schools. They had at least Ferreira in a setter, and it took her a while to get comfortable. And Oregon is using a new scheme this year. They're using a 5-1 that Ferreira isn't exactly used to, and that Pukis does really well with. And I think that if Hannah Pukis is playing against the Washington squads up in Washington, that we win. But I also think that if you have the Hannah Pukis that's had 2 weekends of experience, and she definitely got better in what she was doing. I saw fewer serving and playmaking mistakes in the mountain weekend. I think that if we go back with the experience that we have to the first Washington set, and we have Ferreira there, we still win because she's improved that much.
It is remarkable, you know, especially because like this team, I mean, it's lost some matches, but they're always hard fought, and the Ducks have never been swept. They've swept in themselves a bunch of teams, right? You know, I think they had three different sweeps in the non-con, or four, I think. You know, they swept a number. I think they swept Arizona State twice. They swept number five Stanford. You know, they swept Colorado, right? And like, man, and then in their losses, you know, like I said, no sweeps. You know, they lost. I think their worst loss was 1-3 at USC, and I think Pukas was still out for that match, right? That was coming off of the Washington trip. They had to play like four back-to-back-to-back-to-back, you know, matches, A, on the road, and B, without their setter. And yet they never got swept. They were competitive, you know, against, you know, Washington State and Washington. And they beat UCLA, which, as I recall, is like a decent squad. I don't think they're ranked, but like, yeah. So like, you know, this is a real tough team. I think they definitely deserve their ranking. And now that they're sort of back to full strength and they're, you know, more experienced and they're playing at home, I mean, look, Washington is ranked number 19. This would be a real feather in their cap, you know, move up the rankings a little bit. And sort of like prove that the road games, you know, up in Washington were anomaly. And frankly, that, you know, they owe the Huskies an ass kicking on Friday. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's not all on the setter. There's other aspects of the game that were clicking either that they're doing much better now. Serving is one of them for the Washington State and Washington games. The Ducks were committing 15 service errors to four or five service aces, and that ratio is much closer these days. I think they had the last match something like 8 aces to 10 serving errors, and that's acceptable. When you have that many unforced errors, though, that can hurt you in close games. And so they've worked on the overall package, and it's unfair to pin wins and losses solely on the server. There's a lot of other factors that go into this.
Is there anything else that you're looking out for this weekend against the Washington schools?
Well, Washington State blocks really well, and I want to see what Oregon does to, you know, schematically counter against that. And that's going to be something that I'm looking for. I'm going to be looking for, you know, how the serving game is going, and if we can. If Oregon can keep their hitting percentage up, and, you know, out of the 220s and that kind of stuff, and more into the realm of what we saw last weekend, you know, in the 300s, like I've said in some of my articles, you know, if your overall hitting percentage for the match was 349, you probably didn't lose that match.
Yeah.
But if you get down in the 240s, 220s, then, you know, you're playing against a close game that you might lose.
Well, your articles are fantastic to read. I enjoy them tremendously. You sprinkle them liberally with Twitter videos of play, which are, you know, just thrilling to watch. And Oregon
volleyball is really good about that. We can thank the Oregon volleyball Twitter feed for that. They, I include Twitter feeds from opposing schools, but they don't have nearly the content that Oregon does. So, you know, I try to present both sides of the coin.
But there's no substitute for seeing it in person, and there's only 5 home matches left. The Washington schools this week, and then they're off to the Mountain schools the next weekend. And the weekend after that, they're back in Eugene against the LA schools. They have a midweeker against Cal in Berkeley, and then come back on Friday the 25th back in Eugene against Oregon State, the same day that the football team is in Corvallis to play for the Platy to wrap up their season. So you only got 5 matches left and 2 really good ones. In fact, I think the only ranked team left on their schedule, Washington, on Friday night, which is the Wear Pink night, should be a lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to your coverage of it. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some football. So, did you happen to catch this game against Cal?
Not as much as I would have liked. It was still summer in October, and so I was having to run in and out and catch snippets while I was working on my awful, horrible front deck project.
Oh, boy.
Which is almost done. But, yeah, I had to take advantage of the good weather.
Well, the Ducks had an awful, horrible couple of possessions to start out the game. You know, they drove the field pretty effectively, but, you know, a couple of dropped passes, one of which, you know, bounced off of Troy Franklin's hands and landed in a Cal defender's hands sort of miraculously. You know, so kept, you know, Oregon out of the end zone, even though, you know, Cal was not really stopping them getting down the field. But then, you know, the sort of inevitable asserted itself, and Oregon cruised pretty effectively. You know, it was yet another game in which they won the middle 8 minutes, you know, decisively. It was also interesting to me as the film reviewer to check out the ways that, like, I wouldn't say that Cal has an excellent defense. It doesn't, but they stop you from doing certain things. And in particular, explosive rushing, which had really been like the, in every other game, sort of like the centerpiece of Oregon's offense. Cal's like, oh, we're going to take that away. And we're also going to take away deep shots. And then we'll let you have everything else. But I bet you don't have the patience to use those things to go all the way down the field against us. And Oregon was like, yeah, we do. And
you detail that really well in your film review.
Thank you. But it was really interesting to me, and what I actually feel like I could have spent like twice as much time on, and maybe risked somebody's ire by putting in too many clips. It was like, I could have put the entire Oregon offense into my article because it was so fascinating, you know, what they were doing, which was basically like, you know, Cal wants to take away deep shots, but you need to get some explosive passing yards in order to effectively move down the field, because nobody scores these days 5 yards at a time. You know, like, if you got to go 75 yards to score, you are not putting together 15 consecutive 5-yard runs. Like, it's just, you know, ridiculous. So what Oregon did was, it was a lot of short passing, but then they were set up in a variety of ways. And if you want to know how, you know, you need to read my article. It's difficult to explain on a podcast without a whiteboard or anything else, but like, they were hitting short passes, but then they wouldn't just stop at 3 or 5 or 6 yards. They would be set up so that they would be running into empty space and getting, you know, 25, 30 yards, you know, with a receiver or running back who's out ahead of them to block. Or they'd be, you know, manipulating the defense with sequencing to get them to move, you know, out of the way. You know, and part of that, it, you know, was sort of longer developing plays, where you're getting the defense to back out and then hitting them underneath and then running into the space that was created by the defense backing out, is that you got to have great protection. And that's been Oregon's real secret weapon, although I don't know how secret it is anymore. It's just the offensive line is just like, nobody's laying a finger on Bo Nix. Like, he gets to wait in the pocket for 3 or 4 seconds for plays to develop. And it was pretty useful in this game. And, you know, when they play, you know, teams that have better defenses, I swear there's at least one in the Pac-12, you know, somewhere, you know, like, being able to stand in the pocket and wait for a play to develop to take a, you know, a deep shot. You know, I was, I'm alluding to Utah, to sort of look ahead a little bit here. like, you know, I'm all caught up in my Colorado film. I'll be writing an article about that. It'll be posted on Friday as usual. I finished up all that film. I'm caught up on all my Washington film, at least the games that they've played. Obviously they're playing actually a pretty good, or should be a pretty good game, and definitely a useful one from a film study perspective, against Oregon State on Friday night. I'll be watching that game like a hawk, because Oregon's still got to play both of those teams. And I feel like those are basically like peer programs at this point. Washington and Oregon State, like their talent level is, you know, Washington's talent level sort of fallen off. Oregon State's been sort of like steadily climbing up, and Jonathan Smith has them punching above their weight class. So like that should actually be like a good, you know, real, you know, duke it out battle, and I'm looking forward to that game. But it hasn't been played yet, so I'm caught up on my Washington film, so I'm way ahead. I mean, I'm watching Utah film now, and so, you know, I just finished watching, you know, closely. I know it was played a couple weeks ago, but like I said, you know, I'm working on other projects. I just finished watching the USC versus Utah game, and like Utah's got the most legit defense outside of Oregon in the Pac-12, like far and away. But like the way that their defense is structured, what was the Utah's defense is not as good as it was in 2019. And the primary way that their defense is not as good as it was in 2019 is that it is in pass defense, because they're not really able to get a pass rush unless they blitz. That was very, very clear. When they rushed forward, they, you know, Caleb Williams had all the time in the world to stand in the pocket. And what they went to in the second half was they were blitzing on every play, like up to and including blitzing seven guys. And USC actually didn't respond to that very well. Like they didn't really have a plan for hot routes and stuff like that, which was sort of a surprise, you know, or actually not that much of a surprise, because I don't really think Lincoln Riley's a great game planner. Like it was very clear that they were hitting. They were like their first couple of drives were scripted, and they had a bunch of like fun gadget plays. And then by the second half, they just run out of them, and they were running like a pretty vanilla looking offense. And Utah was starting to shut it down because they were just blitzing at them, you know, constantly. And Riley didn't really have a good answer for it. And ultimately, you know, the fact that they couldn't score towards the end was why they lost that game. That and they couldn't stop Dalton Kincaid at all. But anyway, what was clear when they were just like playing normal, you know, non-gadget football, was that Utah's defensive structure, like in terms of their secondary, they don't expect that pocket to last for 4 seconds, and the zone doesn't. So if you're running drag routes from one side of the field to the other side of the field, in other words, if you're leaving one dude's zone to run into some other dude's zone, and that dude is being run off by like guys who are originally in his quadrant, that like you will be wide open. USC hit multiple passes to wide open dudes because the zone coverage rules didn't allow anybody to run with them, and so there was just literally no one to cover them. And the way that Utah thinks that they're going to defend that is, oh, well, that's not going to be a threat unless the quarterback has 5 seconds in the pocket, and no way is any quarterback going to have 5 seconds in the pocket against Utah's mighty pass rush. Well, guess what? In 2022, Utah's mighty pass rush, you know, was getting stopped dead by USC's offensive line. And, you know, I don't think very highly of USC's offensive line. So I've like
seen the reviews. Yeah.
So USC was hitting some wide open deep shots against Utah's defense. In case you were wondering why the hell I've gone on this long tangent, it was because I started thinking about Oregon's offensive line. And boy, I'm sure Oregon's coaching staff, watching that Utah versus USC game and seeing Caleb Williams having forever to sit up in the pocket and then hitting wide open shots because the zone defensive structure is not running with defenders, or just licking their chops and thinking like, if you see USC's offensive line can do that, like Bo Nix might have 10 minutes, you know, to make throws. Like, yeah.
Well, still, and Dillingham still has to come up with the scheme to take advantage of whatever time he had. It sounds like, you know, against Cal, he came up with a really ingenious way of addressing the situation. And it sounded like it was pretty clever. You know, based on previous Dillingham film elsewhere, before the start of the season, did you see any indication of this from Dillingham? when he was OC at other programs?
Well, yeah, at Florida State. Well, at Memphis, he, I don't want to say that he had an easy job, because I'm not sure I would put it that way. But like, he had maybe the, I'm blanking on his name, Memphis 2018's running back might have been the best running back in the country in 2018. And if you've got a really phenomenal running back who can do whatever he wants, it sort of, it really opens up your options to do stuff off of that, you know, or if you can't figure out anything better to do, you just hand him the ball or you throw him the ball. I mean, to the point where, like, I'm not joking about this. Like, there was at least one game in which I think half of their snaps were wildcat snaps directly to their running back. He was that good. So then at Florida State, they have, it's a general talent upgrade, but I don't think the running back was as good. You know, he didn't have like a one single player that he could just totally rely on. I noticed early that he was good about sequencing, which has been a surprise to me because he's such a young coach. Like, and that's usually, I sort of associate that with like more advanced coaches, like, you know, folks who have been around a while and have started to put together, oh, if I do this and then that. But like, he's pretty good at it. Like, I tweeted out over the summer or over the winter, I guess, when I was writing up about Kenny Dillingham, because they were hired in the winter, obviously. A three-play sequence, it was actually three plays over four, I skipped one of them, in a drive against Miami, in which they line up in the same formation and run three different plays, and each one they sort of it's you know, it's a quarterback power keep you know for one play, and then it's a pitch toss out of the quarterback starts to move like he's keeping the ball, like the first play, to get the defense moving, and then he pitches back the other way, and now the defense is out of the way, and then the third play he starts to move that way, then he starts to pitch that way, and now the defense is split in half, and what does he do when the defense splits in half? He throws at the tight end on the seam down the middle, and the defense is nowhere, you know, near it, but it's all out of the same configuration, and they're all like playing off of each other, and I was like, ooh, sequencing out of like a 30-year-old, you know,
who the fuck?
I know. And so like, it's definitely what I've been on the lookout for, in his time at Oregon. And like every week, you know, I find something where it's like, oh, you put that together to get the defense to do that. You know, to react like, fighting the last war, so to speak. It's been a real treat as a film reviewer.
Nice.
It was definitely the case, you know, against Cal that he needed to do it. Like, less clever offenses have found, you know, like, there's a reason why Cal, even though they're not a super talented team, like, I think they're in the lower third, the lowest third of the talent ratings in the Pac-12, but that they usually keep teams to lower than their season average scoring. And it's because the way that they, you know, use these things. Well, not true of Oregon, right? Like, it's, mm-hmm. you know, their, I think, seventh straight game of scoring 41 plus points. And that, you know, that came down to Kenny Dillingham, and it came down to having a really good quarterback, and it came down to having a really good offensive line and really good skill players. And like, you know, and not just like a good offensive coordinator, but one who doesn't like, he doesn't try to fit a square peg into a round hole, you know, like he's like, oh, you want to take that away from me? Well, but you'll let me do this other thing. Well, then I'll do that other thing. And actually I'll do it better than you think I'm going to do it. You know, like it's not one of these like, oh, you want to stop me from doing this? Well, I need to impose my will on you to show you that you can't stop me from doing the thing that I want to do, you know, which, you know, maybe certain other coaching staffs might have been more tempted to do. Like, nah, he's like, no, I'll just out clever you, you know?
Yeah, and Oregon seems to be attending to the big picture. You know, it may have been that Cristobal couldn't because he was doggedly in pursuit of what he wanted to do and didn't really have the leads to use backups. But it seems to me like Cristobal wasn't comfortable with rotating in backups anyway. It seems to me like Oregon has a number that a cushion that where they want to be in the third and fourth quarters, and if they've established that cushion, then it's garbage time, and what we're going to give is many less developed players some real game time as we can.
Yeah.
And yeah, that causes the other team to seem like they're catching back up and could win, but that's really not what I've seen. And I've really liked how Oregon is developing their, you know, second and third lines.
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, I've got a pretty good relationship with a lot of the Cal writers. It was funny. They sort of, you know, so Cal, I defined garbage time as starting, you know, when Bo Nix gets the touchdown to make the score 35-10. And one of the reasons why it's very clear that that's the final play, meaningful play, is that when Cal gets the ball back after the ensuing kickoff, they put in their backup quarterback, Kai Milner, who then leads two touchdown drives. And the Cal writers were asking me, hey, we're not as familiar with Oregon's defense. Can you tell me what, you know, were those the backups, or how deep were the backups, or, you know, who was he playing against? And I was able to answer their question, that, well, essentially he's playing against Oregon's developmental squad. And that, you know, that's basically how they do it. You know, like they can't do it on the defensive line because they need everybody playing on the defensive line. But for the rest of the team, the inside linebackers and the secondary on the defense, like, yeah, there's definitely clearly a developmental squad for Oregon, and there's a point where they just put them in. And yeah, they give it some points. But like, take your lumps now. This is great. You know, it's absolutely great that they're getting, you know, that experience. You know, against teams that are trying their hardest in real live competitive games at the Power Five level, on the road in bizarrely hot conditions. Like, I think it was warmer in Berkeley than they were expecting it to be, in October in the Bay Area.
Oregon set a heat record for October.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I experienced it.
I agree. That stuff is good to see. And the other thing that was interesting about this game is that I got to see, some new running formations that Oregon was trying out, or new blocking formations anyway, or, you know, blocking schemes, in the run game, which, like, some of them didn't work. And I tried to detail a couple of those in my article. This was their eighth game and they're trying out new stuff, you know, like. And they've got another game coming up against Colorado, which may be another good opportunity to try out, you know, some new stuff. Like, the schedule set up pretty well so that Oregon has, you know, their three tough games, if we're going to, you know, count Oregon State, to finish up the regular season. You know, first of all, two of them are at home, you know, Washington, Utah. But they have, like, a couple of road games against teams that are not, you know, so much of a challenge, in which they can, you know, still be sort of trying out different personnel, blocking schemes, I sort of expect to see some new stuff against Colorado as well this weekend.
Yeah, get ready for end of the season crunch time.
Yeah, right.
Where it counts for all the marbles.
Colorado's been an interesting team to study. They fired their coach. They have been going through three different quarterbacks. They have changed up their defensive scheme, somewhat. They're not really giving up explosive runs anymore. And in that sense, sort of resemble Cal, you know, where, like, their a number one thing now is to stop explosive runs. So, like, I don't know, you might see a sort of similar strategy that Oregon pursues, pursued against Cal. You might see that repeated against Colorado. Or hell, it could be that they break explosive runs against Colorado anyway. Like, that wouldn't surprise me either, if that turns out to be the case.
Did you see what, I think there was a tweet or something about, I don't know if it was a fan tweet or something related to the
Jared Christian Lichtenhan.
Yeah.
He's a rotational left tackle for them. Who's like, oh yeah, we can attack the interior of Oregon's defensive line. They're not that good, or you know, maybe something like that. And I'm like, no, you're not. and definitely not you, buddy. You grade out on my tally sheet pretty poorly. And you've been rotating with a different left tackle for a reason. I don't know why you would say such a thing. It's both false and a bad idea. And he's the worst possible messenger. Like, Oregon's gonna kick that dude's butt. This is gonna sound weird to say, he's too tall for the position. He's 6'10". And if he plays his natural weight is about 30 pounds heavier than he is, and he needs to play under that because he'd be too slow. And so like his center of gravity is all wrong, and he gets knocked on his ass a lot. Like, and I don't mean that figuratively, I mean that literally. I guess I also mean it figuratively.
That's crazy to be too tall though.
I know, but he's 6'10". Like, it's yeah. True. I don't know, like, the interior of Colorado's offensive line is, it's really hot and cold. Like, there are some plays where they look really good, and there are other plays where they look just totally terrible, but the tackles always look terrible. And then on top of that, their quarterback situation has been crazy. They've been rotating three different guys, and one of them now is transferred out of the team. And so it's between, like, this dude who has like all the arm strength in the world, but is super inaccurate. And then this other guy who's a true freshman who is actually better in every statistical category, but he's probably done. He's played 4 games. They're probably going to redshirt him for the rest of the season, because the rest of their season is just bonkers hard. Here's what the rest of Colorado's season is. It's Oregon, USC, Washington, Utah. It's just like, sorry guys.
Do we see a win there? I don't think so.
I don't know, man. They might be Washington. Washington might be just bad. But yeah, it's, you know, Colorado is going to, they're probably going to try to run the ball. They're probably going to try to like establish the run and sort of, you know, play ball control. They're definitely a better rushing offense than a passing offense, or at least a more reliable rushing offense than a passing offense. I was talking to Jack Barsh literally before we started recording, our writer for our sister site, Ralph View Report. I love talking to Jack. He's really funny. We both of us think that Colorado's cornerbacks might be secretly pretty good. It's just that they never get tested because the defensive scheme, especially the one that they're running after the bye when they fired their defensive coordinator and switched Gerald Chapman, like, they really back out the DBs and force the inside linebackers to defend the middle of the field. And their inside linebackers are terrible at doing that. And so every single team has either run right at them and gotten efficiency runs, or thrown at the inside linebackers in the middle of the field, and they just like don't even bother to throw against the cornerbacks. So maybe the cornerbacks are not good. It's just like, why bother, you know, kind of deal. Honestly, Oregon's offense is probably going to have anything that they want, with the possible exception of explosive rushing against this defense. And so it's probably behooves Colorado to try to play ball control and run the ball and try to run down the clock and make it a low possession game against Oregon. But like, that's Oregon's game too, you know, like,
Good luck.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying Oregon's on upset alert or anything, but I would say that like Colorado has a couple of interesting tools. They're probably a little better of a team than you think they are. They had a bonkers non-conference schedule. They played maybe the hardest non-conference schedule in the country. Let me list it for you. It was TCU, like playoff bound TCU, at which the game was 6-7 at halftime, by the way. They played at Air Force, which is probably going to win the Mountain West in crazy weather. Like, it was this like this gloomy, misty weather where everybody kept fumbling the ball. I think there were 9 combined fumbles in that game. Both teams had a fumble on the goal line, like literally like on the 1 yard line. Like, it was like the bizarre, like H.P. Lovecraft kind of game.
I love football in bad weather. That's what football is for.
And then they played at Minnesota. And then their conference opener was UCLA. And UCLA ran all over them. And then they fired their coach. and they've had to go up against, you know, like Oregon State, you know, and but they beat Cal and they played Arizona State okay last weekend. You know, that wound up being a one score game at the end. I feel like, you know, in between all the quarterback changes and the coaching changes and the super hard non-conference and a bunch of like bad balls bouncing against them, like, yes, it's a 1-7 team. I feel like if they had like a normal season, it would be more like closer to like a 3-5 or maybe even 4-4 team. Like if they had like a couple of cupcake, you know, opponents, but they don't, you know, like they don't play Stanford, you know, they don't. Who's the other team from the North that they miss? Stanford and Wazoo would probably be those are potentially winnable games, you know, and they didn't have an FCS opponent and they didn't have an easy G5 opponent. Like there's a normal schedule or a schedule that had the four teams that I just mentioned. Like there's a good chance they win like two of those games and they'd be sitting on like a 3-5 record and people wouldn't be treating them like a joke. Cause I don't think this is really a joke team. I don't think it's a great team or anything. I'm not really saying Oregon's on upset alert, but the idea that like, oh, this is just a total laugher of a team. And Oregon doesn't have, you know, we'll just have whatever they want against them. Like, I don't really think that's true. Or like for any fans who are like, this team, Oregon should be up 28-0 within 5 minutes of this Colorado team. And if they're not, I'm going to, you know, light my hair on fire. Like, come on, you know, they're not that bad.
Especially if, as you say, it starts becoming a ball control battle. Yeah.
And the other thing is their fans have totally showed up, you know, like it was an 0-5 team when they played Cal, like not the most thrilling opponent in the world, but it was a whiteout in which every, you know, and a sellout, you know,
yeah,
and
I saw that. That was just completely crazy to me.
And they sold out their game last week against Arizona State too. And, you know, this game's going to be at Folsom, the Oregon game on Saturday. So, like, yeah, their fans are behind them, which, like, I don't know why. You know, the team's not giving them a lot to root for, but, like, they are. They're showing up. So, like, yeah I mean, if Oregon, again, I'm not saying Oregon's any chance of losing this game, but, like.
You say that too much more, you're going to start putting the listeners in panic mode.
But I guess I, you know, as somebody who has to look every week at the comment section in the ATQ game threads where people are just ready to, you know, chop their furniture into splinters, you know, over any incomplete pass or whatever, you know, the opponent got a first down. That's it. You know, shut it down, shut the season down. I hate Oregon now. I've thrown my pants out the window. You know, like if you're looking at a 1-7 Colorado team and thinking like this should be 28-0 with 10 minutes left in the first quarter and it's not. And so therefore, you know, I'm going to plot, like, you know, come on, man. Like I'm telling you, like Colorado's a little better team than that, you know? So yeah, I mean, it should be a game for a little bit anyway.
Well, I'm looking forward to your preview for sure.
All right, I think it's going to do it for us this week. You got any parting words of wisdom for us, Badwater?
No, I'm not a sage, so I'll just go with Go Ducks.
Go Ducks. All right, thanks for joining us, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.